Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I am delighted to tell you that Celeste Ng joins us in the studio now. Her debut novel, Everything I Never Told You, was award-winning, took home a bunch of awards, including the Massachusetts Book Award and the Asian Pacific American Award for Literature. Now, Celeste is based in Cambridge, but her new book, Little Fires Everywhere, is set in a community of her childhood, Shaker Heights, Ohio, where place, race, family, and identity flow together through Celeste Ng's pen in challenging and unexpected ways. Celeste Ng, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, I don't know if you write your manuscripts with pen or on a computer, but you'll allow me that little literary flourish there. So tell me, I mean, Little Fires Everywhere is a terrific book, but I should note that it's not the only one that you've ever written that Shaker Heights plays an important role in, right?
Well, I've written two books now, yeah. And both of them are set in small towns in Ohio. Okay. And in the first book, I chose to sort of make up a fictional town because I was afraid to write about a real place because there's a lot of responsibility that comes with writing about a place that exists in the world. And in the second novel, Little Fires Everywhere, I decided to take the plunge and set it in my real-life hometown.
Your real-life hometown. So tell us about Shaker Heights and why you decided to take the plunge this time.
So Shaker Heights is a suburb on the east side of Cleveland. It's a really beautiful place. It's got a lot of trees. It's got a lot of green to it. The houses are beautiful. And my parents moved there in the early 90s because it's known for having great schools and it's known for being very racially diverse. At the time, it was almost 50-50 black and white, which is very unusual for Cleveland. And so it was a really great place to grow up. And it was only when I moved away that I started to realize it was a little bit unusual.
Yeah. So, but the thing about places that seem like utopia is that, I guess the common wisdom is that once you scratch the surface of any utopia, you find some dystopian aspects to it. Is that true for Shaker Heights?
I wouldn't say dystopian, but I think that it's fair to say that if you look a little more closely, you can see some of the blind spots that the community still has. It is a very progressive community. It's a place where people are very aware of race, and they talk about race, and they talk about class. And yet, even with all of that attention paid to it, even with that sort of eternal vigilance, there are still blind spots that I think the community has, like any community.
Mm. And so maybe you already answered this, but I'm going to dig a little deeper here. What is it about where you are in your writing career right now that made you decide that, yeah, you could actually set your novel in this real place, that one that you do know so well?
I don't know. It was hubris, I guess, is the answer. But I wanted to try because I had been away from home long enough that I was sort of used to living on my own as an adult, and I had by that time had a child. And I started therefore thinking back to my own childhood, which I think is sort of a natural thing that happens when you become a parent. There's this point of comparison. How was it when I was growing up versus how it is now for my child? And I think thinking about that sort of comparison, comparing the place that I live in now, Cambridge, to the place that I grew up in, comparing the time that we live in now to the time that I grew up in, I would have been a teenager at the time that this book took place in the 90s. That's kind of where that the novel came from, that sort of investigating how far have we come, that question.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about who we meet, who the folks who are at the heart of the novel Little Fires Everywhere. First of all, there's the Richardson family. Really interesting bunch. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, so they are sort of on the outside, at least, the prototypical American suburban family. You know, mother, father. The mother is a journalist for the local paper. The father is a lawyer. They've got four kids who are all like stair-step kids, we used to call them in high school, senior, junior, sophomore, freshman. And they kind of embody the town in a way. They've got roots in the town. The mother's, you know, grandparents live there. And so they're sort of following the rules. They sort of buy into this kind of idea that the town is exceptional in some way and that they're there to set an example.
Right. It's sort of conformity is the word that comes to mind.
But I think so, yeah.
But then in rushes sort of a very, like an opposite force into their lives in the form of Mia Warren and her daughter, Pearl. So tell us about them. And why is it that you decided to bring these two very different types of people together.
Yeah. So Mia Warren and her daughter Pearl come in. They're the strangers from out of town. Mia is in a lot of ways sort of the opposite of this town. She's a wanderer. They move around quite a lot whenever Mia sort of gets the urge. She's an artist, so she doesn't have a very fixed income. She doesn't have a very stable career. And they basically move around in their car. So they have almost no material possessions. They kind of just take whatever they can fit into their car. And they're sort of polar opposites to the Richardson family. And I was really interested in the idea of those two families kind of being drawn to each other. So often you're interested in people who live a life that's really different from yours.
Yeah. So this is, in my reading of it, there's a deep common theme that that courses through the Richardson family, through Mia Warren and her daughter, and another family also in the book, and that is sort of how do we define parent-child relationships, especially when either those children aren't biologically born as a part of their family, or B, even your biological children are perhaps attracted to the parents of another family because they're getting something from that other person that they may not be getting from their own mother and father. I mean, that's a really complicated web. I'm mixing my metaphors now. A complicated web to wade into. But what is it about those kind of relationships that you find so interesting as a novelist?
Well, I've always been interested in the parent-child relationships and the ways that parents, even though you'd think they would be the ones who would understand their children the best, and as a parent, I like to think that I understand my child the best. That's not always true, unfortunately. Sometimes you're so close to your own child that you can't see who they really are or what they really need. And in the novels, you said there are a lot of mother-daughter, mother-child pairings, both between the mother that you're born to and the mother that you sort of choose, or maybe the mother that chose you. And you get different things from those. And of course, your own mother sometimes has feelings about it if you're, you know, turning to another person as a mother figure.
I mean, to speak specifically about it, like Pearl and Izzy here, right? Like Pearl there's a part of her that's really compelled by Mrs. Richardson, and Izzy finds something very compelling in Mia, right?
Mm-hmm. They're, in some ways, I think they're drawn to the woman who's very unlike their own mother. Izzy is sort of drawn to Mia's sort of self-expression and her free spirit, and Pearl, who's always been moved around, is sort of drawn to this sort of very stable, upright pillar of the society sort of figure.
Has that ever happened to you?
I feel like, you know, I'm lucky that I've had a really good relationship with my mother, but my mom is her own specific person. And, you know, my mom is a scientist. She's a chemist. She taught PhD students, and she does research in the lab. And I clearly have turned myself in a slightly different direction as a writer. And so I feel like there have been other women in my life that I turn to for just different kinds of mentoring.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of women feel that. I think my sisters probably felt that. And, you know, friends of mine, you find people that you turn to, and there's often a moment where you go, well, wait, am I betraying my own mother in some way by turning to this other person for advice?
So I know exactly how you feel. I mean, it's funny, your mom's a chemist, so is mine.
Really?
I mean, and I adore my mother, but she's a chemist. She's very sort of logic and accomplishment oriented, and of course also being an immigrant, an American by choice, there was always that drive from the beginning to, you know, like there are life goals, and so I got that drive from her. But I did find that maybe not so much when I was younger, but in my teen years, and funnily enough, in my 20s and 30s, just like you said, like in other women, I found sort of other aspects of ways of being that nurtured me that I didn't get from my mother.
Yeah, I think that's basically exactly the experience I had. My mother, also an immigrant, you know, an American by choice. She came over in the 60s, you know, went to school, got her PhD, has been, you know, working here, you know, until she retired a few years ago. And she's very, you know, she's very much in the science mode of thinking. She's very logical. She's very problem-solving oriented, and she gets things done. And I got that from her. But at the same time, every now and then there are times where you, as you said, you want to experience a different way of being in the world or a different way of relating to the world. And
yeah.
I feel like that's natural, and yet it also, I had a lot of guilt about
me
that.
Me too. It's very, it makes you feel really fraught, because it feels like a kind of, as you're saying, a little bit of a betrayal, even though it's not, but it feels that way.
That's exactly it, and I think about it now as a parent, as I know you are also, where I sort of think, well, what about those moments where your kid says, oh yeah, but I want to go over to that person's house because their mom does this, you know, or no, I want to do that with grandma. And there's a little bit where you're like, oh,
Yeah.
You don't want to do that with me, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I find myself, it's like I'm coming back around finally to a deeper appreciation of my mother now that I've got my own children to mother.
That's exactly where I am as well, where I'm sort of now, I feel like there are certain things where I understand why she did things when I was a kid, or I see things now from her point of view in a way that I thought I did before, but I realize that I really didn't quite understand before. And now I feel like I'm starting to understand a little better.
Well, this seems like a great place for me to ask you if you could read an excerpt from Little Fires Everywhere, because I want folks to hear your writing. The writing's also beautiful as well. So could you do that?
Sure. So this is just to frame it, a little passage in which Mia, who is the mother who comes from out of town, is thinking about her relationship with her daughter, Pearl. After Pearl had begun to snore softly, Mia kept her hand in place, as if she were a sculptor shaping Pearl's shoulder blades. She could feel Pearl's heart, ever so faintly, beating under her palm. It had been a long time since her daughter had let her be so close. Parents, she thought, learned to survive touching their children less and less. As a baby, Pearl had clung to her. She'd worn Pearl in a sling because whenever she'd set her down, Pearl would cry. There'd been scarcely a moment in the day when they had not been pressed together. As she got older, Pearl would still cling to her mother's leg, then her waist, then her hand, as if there were something in her mother she needed to absorb through the skin. Even when she had her own bed, she would often crawl into Mia's in the middle of the night and burrow under the old patchwork quilt, and in the morning they would wake up tangled, Mia's arm pinned beneath Pearl's head, or Pearl's legs thrown across Mia's belly. Now, as a teenager, Pearl's caresses had become rare, a peck on the cheek, a one-armed, half-hearted hug, and all the more precious because of that. It was the way of things, Mia thought to herself, but how hard it was. The occasional embrace, a head leaned for just a moment on your shoulder, when what you really wanted, more than anything, was to press them to you and hold them so tight you fused together and could never be taken apart. It was like training yourself to live on the smell of an apple alone, when what you really wanted was to devour it, to sink your teeth into it and consume it, seeds, core, and all.
Oh, that's Celeste Ng reading from her new novel, Little Fires Everywhere. Oh, that really gets to me, Celeste, I have to say, because right now both my kids are in single digits, so, and every time their sort of Velcro-y nature gets to me, I'm gonna reread this passage and remind myself that I will miss it.
I'm in exactly soon. The same spot with my son has just started first grade, and he's very into being independent, and then every so often he's very clingy, and I have to kind of remind myself, you're gonna miss that.
Gonna miss it. I'm gonna think about the smell of an apple. Well, so there's also this aspect of the book which is really important that we haven't touched on yet, and it has to do with sort of how we define and how society defines what an appropriate family actually is, right? Because there's also the story in the novel about a white family raising a Chinese baby.
Mm-hmm. There's been a Chinese baby that's been abandoned at the fire station, and she's been adopted by a well-to-do white family living in Shaker Heights that are friends of the Richardsons. And one of the subplots of the novel has to do with the mother of this Chinese baby who kind of wants her child back. And the question of who this child belongs to, whose mother, you know, who is the child's mother, right, in terms of the law, but also in terms of actual sort of psychology. Who is it, the mother who gave birth to her, or is it the mother who's been taking care of her? And it leads, in fact, to a sort of conflict in the community that actually divides the entire community and causes a split between the Richardsons and between Mia and Pearl.
I mean, is there, at the risk of sounding too simplistic, does your opinion fall on one side or the other?
I can't decide, honestly. It sounds like an authorial cop-out, but one of the things that I wanted to do was just sort of to pose this question and to show how complicated this situation is, that both of these mothers, really both of these sets of parents, have a claim on this child and love this child and have a reason to want this child in their lives, and that whichever family the child ends up with, unfortunately, she's going to be missing something.
Yeah, interesting. You know, the novel takes sort of grapples with sex, abortion, surrogacy, adoption, as we've been just talking about, abandonment. I mean, you pack in a lot, almost every aspect about, you know, the way we don't or don't have children. That's, I mean, first of all, how'd you do it? And second of all, why?
I guess it was just something on my mind. The more I started to work on the novel, the more that it started to kind of give me clues about what it wanted to be. That sounds very New Agey, but I do think there's a point at which the novel picks up a certain amount of momentum for itself, and it starts to sort of resonate with itself. And so once I started thinking about mothers and daughters, or mothers and children, more sort of mother-child pairings kept coming up, and they started to sort of echo each other in ways that felt like they were adding to the story. And so, as you said, these questions of abortion, or these questions of adoption, or these questions of surrogacy, and the questions of infertility, all of the sort of ways that I think we have ideas as a society about how people should have children, whether they should have children, who gets to, who deserves to. All of that sort of started to wind itself up into the ball of the story, so to speak.
Mm. And you do it so very well, I have to say. Finally, I just wonder, you know, we talked a little bit about how your upbringing in Shaker Heights, we talked about our mothers as well. I mean, how much do you appreciate, maybe I'm asking this as a person who speaks to a lot of authors, and sometimes I wonder, should I be sort of saying, like, here's an author that, in part because of her own ethnic background, engages a lot with issues of ethnicity and race? Because I always wonder if authors, like, push back against that because they're also just writing great stories.
No, I feel both sides of that question, actually, because especially when I started off as a debut author, I was really nervous about being pigeonholed.
Right, as the new Chinese-American
exactly
writer.
Right, the next Amy Tan, like, there can only be one, and somebody has to knock her off the pedestal in order to, you know, get anywhere, which is something that I really, really struggle against and really push back against now that I have a little bit of a voice. I think as a writer of color, you know, somebody who's been in marginalized situations in different ways, I think that I'm really aware of what it's like to be an outsider. And so even when I'm writing, as in this novel, about many characters who are white, I still think that I bring to it the perspective of what it's like to be an outsider, and how hard that can be, and how that can shape someone.
Yeah. Well, what I really appreciated in the book is that even though it's set in the 90s, as you said, it still felt thoroughly modern, sort of, it just in the matter-of-fact way that the characters sort of interact with each other, that obviously ethnicity and race and heritage are issues, but they're not like the immediate defining issues. So I think that's the way most of us, on a day-to-day basis, hopefully that's the way a lot of us live.
Hopefully so. I think, you know, I don't usually walk around going like I'm Asian walking down the street and I'm
exactly.
Asian eating my lunch. But I think you're touching on something that I'm realizing as this book is coming out into the world, that I started it in 2009, and when I was writing it, the world was in a very different place.
Uh-huh.
And you know, the book is set in the 90s, and now I'm realizing both how far we've come and also maybe how far we have not come.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, the new novel is Little Fires Everywhere. Celeste Eng will be speaking tomorrow night at Porter Square Books about it. We've got a lot more information about the novel at our website, radioboston.org. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Celeste. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations on the book. It's terrific.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.